Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back. You're with Greenwashed. I'm Jaspreet here with Don Nicholson and a guest who's beaming in from Canada this morning, B. Lorraine Smith. So if you've been listening to Up the Brave Show with Natalie Cutler-Welsh, you would have heard Lorraine's voice recently in this episode on corporate sustainability, deciphering greenwash and the path to industrial healing. And Nat gave Don and me a shout out there and said we must speak to Lorraine about ESG and sustainability and all the things we speak about here in Greenwash. So we made the connection. A bit of background to Lorraine. She's worked for a couple of decades in corporate sustainability and ESG until she realized that her efforts were actually worsening the problem that she aimed to solve. And she's now challenging industry norms and confronting some of those very unpalatable truths. So welcome, Lorraine. Don and I are very glad to have you on Greenwash today.
Thanks so much, Jaspreet and Don. It's a pleasure to be here.
And so let's get right into this. This year in New Zealand, we have had bad news after bad news. We've had our national carrier, Air New Zealand, dumping its 2050 sustainability targets. But in the meantime, what it did was it planted some of our biodiversity hotspots in the blighted pines. And I prefix the adjective blighted behind the pines because I have just become really, really cynical about all of this. We've also had IKEA, the sustainable furniture maker, which the Swedish multinational, which since 2021 has bought more than 23,000 hectares of land in New Zealand to plant pines. It aims to increase its furniture production while offsetting its carbon emissions. And the New Zealand legislation gave it the privilege to do so. Now, this is devastating the rural economies and even the urban economies. It's devastating some of our pristine swaths of what should have been prime pastoral land or just biodiversity that was there because pines are monoculture. And yet we have these corporates waxing lyrical, writing, you know, one hard-hitting report after another about how well they are doing on the sustainability stakes. And that's where you have done a lot of work, Lorraine. So we'd be interested to know your thoughts. How much of this do you see? This is just a couple of New Zealand examples, but how much have you seen in your line of work?
Yeah, thanks for that intro. And I'm sorry to hear that. I can feel the pain and suffering as you describe it, and it's not unique. And I don't think it's going to be any less anytime soon. So I think it's a really important conversation to have. I'll maybe just back up a step and give you a sense of my perspective, where I'm coming from on this and, mm-hmm. and how I see these very corporate initiatives that you're describing. And I guess I feel a bit sheepish in that I have been a part of that problem for quite a long time. So beginning in 2003 is when I entered the field of corporate responsibility in my home country of Canada. And I began working with many of Canada's large retail, mining, banking, oil and gas companies in those years. Around 2008, I stepped away and began freelancing. And in that capacity, I ended up moving to New York City and began working for another firm at a certain point. And I feel even more sheepish there because that firm really was in many ways part of creating this notion of the triple bottom line. It was called sustainability, right? It's still called sustainability. It bought the URL. It was so avant-garde in the field some time ago. And I really enjoyed that work. I worked with incredible people, great teams, very committed. And I actually want to put this very early on. Everyone I've worked with up close and personal, I would say, is genuinely trying to help, trying to make the environment healthier, trying to enable people to have better jobs and look after themselves better. However, what I saw happening in those 10 years in New York was we would go further and further into more senior roles, working with more senior people within these large Fortune 500 companies. And there I was working internationally. So lots of, again, big banks, lots of large extractive companies, mining, oil and gas, big forestry in Brazil. I'm a Brazilian Portuguese speaker, so that got me over to Brazil and doing some work there. And over, I was seeing as we were creating their sustainability strategies, as we're developing their ESG disclosures, their investor communications, their reporting, their TCFD, GRI, you know, name the alphabet soup, compliant reports, that we were doing a lot of box checking, sometimes talking with a lot of folks on the ground, stakeholder engagement, we might call it, but never were we actually enabling life to thrive. And I want to just put a finer point on that because to me, that's the ultimate filter. And that brings me back to the IKEA and Air New Zealand situation. I was kind of shocked to learn over and over, but eventually really seeing it quite clearly that most folks in business, in decision-making roles, in fact, I'm just going to go out on a twig and say most folks haven't ever considered that the economy can and really ought to serve life. Like that's what it's there for, is to enable us to meet our needs, to be well, safe, enjoying our lives, and looking after one another in a healthy home that we might call Earth or we might call the environment. That doesn't really occur to most people. They might have language like, oh, we need to conserve nature or we need to provide good jobs. So there might be some language that seems to hint at that. But when you actually challenge, shouldn't the economy serve life and not the other way around? I can tell you firsthand, you will probably get laughed at. Like, that's not what the economy's for. And then you go, well, what is it for then? Is it for life to serve it? And if so, then we start to see, ah, that's why so much life gets sucked into the economy, gets co-opted, gets oppressed, gets used in order to serve this growing wealth hoarding machine that is a part of the economy that most of us don't have the benefit of controlling or benefiting from, frankly. So that sounds a bit cynical, but I began to see over and over that much of what was going on with sustainability and ESG, in spite of beautiful intentions and great teams and fun times, frankly, lots of conferences, was enabling business as usual, which is growth as usual, which is wealth and financial means hoarding as usual, and the financialization of markets. So I kind of tapped out, and I can say a bit more about what that looks like now, but just landing on IKEA and Air New Zealand, I see that type of activity playing out here as well, where in the name of carbon neutrality or net zero or some latest buzzword, we're pushing initiatives forward that make sense on paper, but they do not serve life. They do not serve the local communities, maybe in small ways you can justify, but not writ large, not at a system level. And
And
they do not enable more ecologically sound communities.
if we back up a bit for our listeners, now I was in banking in India before we immigrated to New Zealand, my husband and I, in 2009. I was working with the Citibank, mortgage underwriting. This was, the days, heydays of before 2008, 2009. It was high risk, high rewards, and all of that. And it was that time we had the CSR come into our roles, corporate social responsibility. It all sounded very well and good. And yeah, we should be doing the right. And that's what you're doing. But yet at the same point, and Don might gasp here, but the interest rates we were giving on these loans that were bending the norms in India because they didn't meet. I was working with the NBFC, so the Citibank's non-banking financial arm. So there you can sort of, you don't have to meet all the norms that a bank has to. The average interest rate for the mortgages we were giving was about 15 to 16%. Most of those, the people would only have them for 1 or 2 years. It was basically a business loan, but packaged as a mortgage. Short term, high risk, high rewards. And I used to think, right, we talk of corporate social responsibility. There are these guys who are be absolutely arm twisting into these exorbitant rates. At that point, the nationalized banks were giving loans at 4, 5, 6%. Ours were at least 10% more than that. Some of the people who were taking the smaller personal loans out, and I was not involved in that, but I was in the mortgage arm, were, I would see them come into office. These were people absolutely down on their luck, and they were paying 20, 25% for short-term loans. And there we were talking about all of this. In India,
Yeah.
Citibank, just like everything else, worked 6 days a week. Saturday was a working day in India. And yet on Saturday, the attendance register used to be taken off. And every time the auditors would come from the Citibank in the US once a year, it was shown that we were a 5 day working week. We were never a 5 day. Saturday, we would go home at 2:33. But if I myself remember telling, if at any time walking in, there was a guard at the bank all the time. And if the attendance register was ever there, I should tell him, I used to call the gentleman and say, could you please take the register away? It's a Saturday. And he'd say, oh, sorry. So all of this is going on. I used to think, why are we doing all of this? All right, that was corporate social responsibility, obviously, with all of those loans and all of that subterfuge. We were still ticking off some boxes. It went on to ESG over time, when suddenly, not just looking after the communities or helping them out, we're now looking after the environment. That got added in. Then one after the other, countries, and around that time you migrated here, you had countries putting in carbon into it. Like, we need to go after this net zero nirvana. And you can't blame businesses, can you? Businesses are there for business. And if you're going to change the rules, they're going to somehow tick them off and still continue doing this. A mining company is still going to be mining. A farmer like me is still going to be farming. Someone selling EVs is still going to be doing that. But they're going to do, if you change the rules of the game, they will play along. And as you said, Lorraine, most of the people that you have met who are on the ESG side of things, sustainability consultants and all, I've met a few in my time, very earnest people. We have these ones coming from our, primary industry sector. They have these consultants. But do they actually realize what they are a part of? I don't know. I've come across these really fresh-faced, earnest people.
Oh, yeah. I get calls all the time from folks wanting to sort of do an informational interview. How do I get into the field? And I always do. But I'm sure they come away slightly confused after talking to me, because I say, what do you think the field is? There's this sense of we're just going to fix things. And I mean, I'll give a concrete example of where I see very clear trouble. And it's just right there in front of us, but most people don't look at it. And then I'll give my answer for what we do about it. I'd be curious what you all think of this. In Canada, we're part of our national policy around climate action includes a net zero by 2050 plan. And you folks have seen this in lots of different contexts, I'm sure. And there's all kinds of elements to this plan and how it will come together. One such element is with regard to electric vehicles. And I'm going to stay neutral for the purposes of this anecdote. I'm going to stay neutral on whether or not I like cars. I like electric cars. I'm 100% neutral. This is purely describing in the context of a government policy that claims to be about a cleaner, greener economy. So I'm going to paraphrase that and say, I think that means it's trying to enable ecological wellness, biodiversity, safe community life, right? It's about doing something positive. I'll just believe that that's the intention based on the words, and there's lots more words. Okay, so let's take a look at how that incentive plan is going on their electric vehicle part of the plan. They have a consumer incentive where a consumer buying a new car that qualifies based on a zero emissions criteria that they've made very clear, typically an electric car, they can get up to $5,000 as a rebate. And $5,000 Canadian, so I'm not sure exactly. I think that actually nets out similar for New Zealand dollars. It's a little bit more than $4,000 US for anybody looking at, the gold standard dollar out there for now. And so that's a lot of money, $5,000 to be given for buying a new car. What does that look like? Well, in the last few years, so this has been in place since 2019. So we've got 4 years of data. And just the other day, I actually did a little follow-up, actually after speaking with Nat on Up Your Brave, I realized I referenced this, but I hadn't looked at the stats closely. So I went back in and thought, I want to just fact check and make sure I'm not misremembering. I was not misremembering, and there was new data since I had last looked. There have been hundreds of thousands of new cars purchased under this principle and billions of taxpayer dollars handed out. So let's just be clear on what that actually means. What that means is about 4,000 new BMWs were subsidized. 50,000, more than 50,000. And by the way, this is 1 year of stats. It goes back to 2019. Just in 1 year, 4,000 BMWs, hundreds of Mercedes, tens of thousands of Teslas, numerous SUVs. These are luxury vehicles. So we got to be we could guess that at least most of the people buying those are not poor. They're probably what we would typically call wealthy, being paid cash by the government to buy new cars. So this clean environmental policy is paying rich people to put more cars on the road, hundreds of thousands of cars on the road. And with taxpayer money, to me, this is so bonkers. And just to clarify how bonkers it is, let's just imagine for a moment we go to a 12-year-old who doesn't drive, doesn't have a car of average means, and you say, hey, 12-year-old, your job going forward is to make the environment cleaner. This person has no post-secondary education, possibly only barely literate. No 12-year-old in their right mind would say, you know what I think we should do? I think we should put hundreds of thousands of new cars on the road. And you know what? We should give some rich people money to do that. Like, it's just bonkers. It makes no sense. So I promised I'd tell you what I think we should do about it. This is big. And I really want to know what you guys think of this, actually, because you've been thinking about this for quite a while.
Should let Don have a word there. EVs, Don?
Oh, yeah.
And all the financing we are giving here for the chargers, he's probably got better stats than we.
Please.
Oh, well, worse. We called it a fee bait. For about 3 years, we were taking money off tradesmen and people like farmers who were wanting to buy machinery and vehicles for their farming or business, and we were giving that money. It was actually a tariff on their extra tariff on their purchase, and giving it back to EV users or purchasers in this country. So it was called a fee bait, a really deceptive set of words. And of course, now we've got a prime minister who's continuing the old prime minister's push, which is they want 11,000 charging stations around New Zealand, which is a relatively small country. And my view is there will be co-funding, there'll be private-public partnerships for that. But I don't think when we put fuel stations around New Zealand way back 100 years ago that anyone would have been subsidized to do it. So no. And on top of all that, Lorraine, we don't even have the electricity right now to feed into these big hyperchargers. We're short of electricity all of a sudden. We've got a population that's expanded by about, a couple of million in 30 years. And
oh, wow.
we started with 3 or 4, 3.5 million.
Yeah.
We're now 5.5 million. We haven't expanded our infrastructure or kept up with that need. And now we're short of electricity. But we've still got all this virtuously, politicians playing the virtuous card. We just want the electricity to be abundant and affordable. And we've got anything but abundant and affordable electricity in this country right now. So, look, that was a long story, but I want to hear your edge. What you said you've got a point you're gonna drop us with. Let's hear it, because I'm interested to hear it.
Yeah, have I got a fix for you?
This is the scoop. This is the scoop.
Yeah. Well, actually, let me just comment briefly on what you just described. And I say this with a sense of sort of mercy, because it's so easy to think that this is the right thing to do, right? How could we argue against greener vehicles? What's wrong with you people? And there is a real risk. I probably walk it more than I realize, of being framed as some kind of, you know, anti-progress radical or anti-business or anti-car or, you know, extreme right wing, or all these words get thrown around. And so I want to triple emphasize that I'm really interested in any solution, any policy, any step, any fee, rebate, whatever, that genuinely enables people to be well. And like the people doing the work, the people growing the food, the people building the electrical systems, you know, the people who, the folks who work hard day in, day out to enable us to be well. And those seem to be the last people on the benefiting edge of these policies, which really worries me, because the language is often around, you know, we're making it better for everybody, but actually we're making it worse for a lot of people and making it, I mean, this is so boring, but it's like the rich get richer while the poor get poorer, you know? And it's really, yeah. But let me give you my, what I think we need to do about it. This is awkward, what I think we need to do about it, but it is what I believe, and it's coming from years of not wanting this to be true, but bumping into it again and again. It starts at that kind of mindset level that I described. So realizing that the economy really can and should, and I believe will, serve life, not the other way around. We are not here to be extracted from or controlled. We are here to live well, to look after each other, to look after ourselves and thrive and enjoy the bounty that is life. And so with that in mind, then I believe any business decision, ESG, sustainability, or just general business modeling needs to contemplate how, not just contemplate, but execute on how it serves life. And if it can't answer that, it needs to pause, because so much of business is like, do we need more IKEA furniture? Quick answer, no.
No.
We got plenty, right? Like, the business models of today are, this is no new headline, but they are generally speaking predicated on endless growth. And that endless growth is extractive, oppressive, and frankly, often like literally genocidal, depending on where you're coming from and what's going on. So we must recognize that. And I believe in many cases, and this is really awkward, and I'd be curious what you think, because we may not be aligned on this, and I'd love to know where you're at on this. I believe when we follow this through, much of what we see, especially in major global industry, is I see a dramatic need for a decrease. So what we talk about as consumption, I believe it needs to be cut by about 95%. When I look at what needs to happen with vehicles, for example, like, sure, electric vehicles, that's one option. There's lots of different ways to get around, but I don't know anybody who wants to sit in more lanes of traffic. And I lived in New Zealand for a year. I don't know how it's changed. I was there in 97, 98. But here in Canada, we have one of the widest highways in the world. It is repulsive. It is traumatizing. People hate it. It's gross. And what are we doing? We're widening it so more cars can fit on that. I don't care if they're run by electricity or horse manure. They're shitty. We should not be growing this economy. We should be growing the economy that treats our hearts and minds well, that treats our families well, that treats our farmers well. And growing that economy does not mean producing more cheap furniture. It does not mean producing more cars. So my tidy little solution is, ask, how is this business decision serving life? Ensure that it is. And notice that the vast majority of those decisions for many companies in many sectors around the world will require a reduction materialization and a reduction in consumption, a significant one. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, so effectively you're pushing talking about a degrowth agenda, and we've sort of looked into that a little bit as well. Are you frowning about that? Yeah, I've got you wrong.
Well, I refute the word degrowth. Mm-hmm. Maybe. I guess I would just say there may be places for enormous growth, tremendous untapped growth, right, that is self-propagating in healing ways. Mm. I mean, boy, could we use a heck of a lot more people who think that industrial healing is a notion? Please grow, 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 you know, yeah. But we do not need more things that cause harm and destroy. So I refute although I appreciate it, and maybe being a bit glib, I'm cautious about just slapping degrowth on it, because most people hear shrink, you know, fear, reduce, everything's bad. And I think that misses the tremendous power of those forests and those biodiverse regions that are being trampled by the blighted pine. That's not a degrowth. You know, when you let a forest be a forest, that's not degrowth.
Hmm.
That's effective, self-reinforcing, beautiful abundance. And that pine forest is its growth, but it's a kind of cancerous growth. So bring on the growth, but the healthy, self-propagating growth that brings us wellness, not harm. Does that make sense? And I kind of cut you off there, Don, so please keep going. Steer me straight.
No, it's fine. I mean, we've we're talking about ESGs, and we've talked about corporate reporting and all that sort of stuff, and we've got the roles of banks now becoming all powerful about who they lend to and why they lend. We've got fund managers being all powerful. You know, many of the Canadians will have a pension fund that's got lots of fund managers working into the ESG paradigm. And we've got a rules-based order in this world, supposedly. But it seems that it's just feeding. It's all about the destruction of competition. Oh, I got this big thing, Lorraine, and it's around competition. I love competition. But everything we seem to be talking about here is about the removal of competition. And I can't reconcile it. I mean, I like to know that the environment's great and we use the being preserved as best we can, and we use the resources of the world wisely, because you'd have to be in complete denial if you thought you didn't use the resources of the world and everything we live and breathe and purchase and our purchasing as well. So it's a big cluster of stuff that I can't quite get my head around, Lorraine. But we do know, well, I know, this is my assertion, we're living in a new global elite sort of paradigm where we came out of the feudalism age perhaps 200 years ago, but we're now going into this new global capitalist system, which is really about a new techno-feudalism era. Mm-hmm. And what can we do to stop it? Because I don't like it. I mean, I just see all these people feeding off the energy that my farm gives up through its meat and milk. The energy that comes from that farm is being redistributed through the purchasing powers of the consumer. But there's so many reef fish on the way that actually aren't adding a hell of a lot of value, and the consumer's paying for it all. So I know that's a big... probably a lot of stuff, contradictions in there, but
I'll pipe in here. You know, the consumerism we are talking about, and I think perhaps that's where you were going towards, Lorraine. And I can remember growing up in a simpler time. I had fewer choices, be it clothes, be it toys, be it books. Far simpler choices than my two children have today to make. I recently moved house, and with the previous house that we had stayed for nearly 4 years, with two young children, the amount we accumulated, gosh, it was a mission. And then I look at what comes across my Facebook feed. I don't have TikTok, don't intend to have that, but my Facebook, this thing, you'll have reels of people unboxing a haul from Walmart, from Shein somewhere in China, all sorts of polyester and so on. And I'm a keen op shopper. And then you go and you see the stuff with tags lying in op shops. And you look at it, you know, no one valued that. My mind also goes back to the Indian subcontinent, Bangladesh specifically. Nearly a decade ago, the Rana Plaza, they collapsed. Old Navy, Gap and all were building these, they were manufacturing clothing there, cheap clothing that gets sold to the rest of the world there. And today, a decade on, nearly a dozen years from that on, the big brands like Levi and IKEA are still refusing to sign this new accord that they have called the Corporate Due Diligence Directive, because what would be needed there to actually ensure all of that, they know is not possible. So I look at that, and I have a very cynical worldview towards all of this. I do think we need to reduce some of our footprint, not a carbon footprint as much, just the sheer stuff we own, just the sheer stuff we are hankering after.
Well, we've got habits, haven't we?
We have got habits, and I'm one to talk. God, my car always has a box, more than one box, lying. One to take haul books off to the charity shop, and the other for clothes and shoes, and, you know, kids outgrow them at a rapid pace. Always have two cartons I'm lugging around. And I look at it, and we've just gone on. But then there is the corporate virtue signaling. You have people thinking an almond latte is really good, and whereas if you look at almonds growing in the arid areas of California is a dry area, and 10% of the groundwater in that state goes towards almonds. And how virtue, you know, how good is your almond latte there if you will not have New Zealand milk, because supposedly we are environmental vandals. And I do think this corporate speak, the ESG, and all of these, you know, tick boxing exercises from banks, from the accounting firms, the big consulting firms, they have completely perverse outcomes. Completely perverse outcomes. Yeah. Just like Dawn, free markets, if they were truly free, but we don't have free markets anymore. We have these powers that have more wealth and control than many of the smaller countries' economies. They dictate what is grown where, what is sold where. And we just sort of seem to be pawns in this game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel what both of you are saying. And as you noted, Dawn, it's a big kind of cluster of challenges. And I won't pretend that I'm going to solve them quickly with my little mindset of, you know, abundance and working in service of life and radically shifting this materialized consumptive pattern towards a more self-propagating pattern. I'll tell you my approach to that, because, you know, I'm not immune to it. I can definitely be very saddened or worried. It's not nice feelings. But I have a pretty clear way that I address it, which is I've been asking myself, and frankly, it's why I made the pivot I did in October 2021. I ask myself, well, what's mine to do on that? Because I don't like it either. And I largely agree and observe similar to what you both just described. We're in different parts of the world and we do different things with our time. And I imagine our families do too. And yet there's a lot of common ground between what you just described and my experience, my observations. So I, you know, nobody's calling me and saying, hey, I'm in charge of a huge swath of the economy and I wonder what you think I should do about it tomorrow, right? So, and also no one's calling me and saying, I was looking for a new mindset and I wondered if you could suggest one for me. You know, it's just not what my job is. So I've taken another job, which is asking myself, where do I have a unique array of skills, relationships, and perspective that I can sort of hyper-focus, like the magnifying glass, you know, setting the leaf ablaze when we were kids, learning how to really focus the light, not focus the darkness, because focusing darkness, I find, just brings more darkness, frankly, and there's plenty to go around. So what does it look like when I really focus my skills, my relationships, my perspective in service of life, which is what I think businesses should be doing? So what does it look like when I turn that back on me? And it just so happens I have 20 years of experience in ESG. I kind of predate ESG even being a term. It was very not said in 2023. Now it's, you know, books and consultancies are built around it. I predate the TCFD. I predate, well, the GRI was kind of hatching when I came on the scene. So I've kind of been there, done that in those trenches. And I'm not an activist. I used to work at World Wildlife Fund. That was an interesting beginning job out of school. So good experience. But I also used to work in electronic engineering. I actually worked for a manufacturer in New Zealand, in Auckland in 1998. So I've been in a lot of different trenches. So I take my job as holding an awareness of the challenges you have both described and doing my best to stay tuned to them, not block them out, not sugarcoat them, not take them in constantly, because that's mentally devastating, but let flow information, and then apply my skills to make real change. And so for me, that looks like I pretend I've been hired by the economy in service of life. That's my client. It's a kind of fictitious client. There's different departments in the client. And that client has asked me to do consulting work, which I did for 20 years. I know how to scope projects, do research, compile and analyze and write and present and do the consulting work on behalf of that economy and present it in the ways that would resonate with folks who do make decisions in business. So I continue to produce my own kinds of reports that I think might actually be more valuable, that might make sense. They don't just check boxes. And I continue to provide guidance to folks who welcome it. I can't jam it down your throat, but if you're interested and you really want to spar or get some advisory input on ESG and sustainability, I can help. And I speak. I bring my voice. I have conversations like this with people like you around the world to say, well, what are you seeing? And, you know, what would be possible? And I feel like that's my lane. And you know, my lane isn't government policy and it's not EV battery optimization and all kinds of other important things that are going on. But I do know a lot about ESG disclosures. So why don't I apply that practice in service of life and see what happens? And then beyond that, you know, I invite you and your listeners to wonder, you know, what's my lane? What's my expertise? Where do I see great resource, great talent, great action in service of that? And what can I build on and cultivate to make that true without giving up and also without being Pollyanna and pretending that it isn't actually kind of a crazy shit show right about now?
Hey, well, and on that vein, you've got a concept called materiality, MATERIALITY. And so that's your big game at the moment, big gig at the moment. You're actually going around running forums under that moniker. And I assume that it's mother. Does the mater sort of, is it a play on Mother Earth sort of? Is that what it's about?
Well, you
industrial
know,
industrial healing, I know.
Yeah. Words are funny. They sometimes sneak up on me unexpected. I am sure many of your listeners will be very familiar with ESG materiality assessments, spelled with an I. And I have done dozens of them and been a stakeholder interviewed and dozens more. So I kept saying, you know, there's no reality in materiality. We need to put reality in there. So in fact, my spelling of materiality is putting reality into materiality. But, you know, very shortly after I started to tinker with it, and for a while I was just doing materiality assessments, reality-based, and I created a methodology that's free. Anyone can download it from my website if they like. At first, I was just kind of conducting these assessments and putting them out there, just sharing them. And somebody reached out, a lovely woman that I worked with over the years, to say, oh, I love that you brought the mother into materiality. Yeah. And I have to tell you very candidly, I am getting goosebumps remembering it because I didn't realize it. I hadn't thought of it. So
it was my first thought as a mere male. It was my first thought.
Whereas I thought the other way, you know, having worked in accounting, it was materiality, whether something is material or it's immaterial. So I went the other way, Dawn, here.
Yeah. And it reminds us that language is sometimes just a place to play and explore. It can also be weaponized. That's a whole other chat. But yeah, materiality is a methodology I created. And increasingly, I'm spending my time using this lens of putting reality to ESG and sustainability. And I do host workshops and coaching sessions. And I also produce reports, but they're much more playful and much more life-oriented. No more box checking. It just doesn't make sense. So I'll say very simply what it is, because it might be, I hope it's useful. It's really just three questions. What does a company say their purpose is? What do they actually do to earn revenue? And what does the world need of a company of that sort in order to serve life? So a simple example would be Google. They say their purpose is to make all the world's data accessible to everyone everywhere. How do they make money? They sell advertising. Those are very different purposes, right? They're not mutually exclusive. But as a purpose, very different. So what does the world need from a company that makes data accessible? Well, the mind reels. And so I did an assessment, reaching out to stakeholders, recorded a bunch of interviews, asked a wide range of folks from around the world, what would a Google that truly serves life by making data accessible look like for you? Needless to say, there were lots of really beautiful answers. And none of them said, yeah, they should probably sell more advertising. So that's how those kinds of assessments work. It's a lot of fun.
And well, that's probably where, Dawn, and that's probably where it is. What companies say they do and what they actually do are two completely different things. You threw in a couple of words, the buzzwords there. And for our listeners, I'll just sort of extrapolate on them. You spoke about GRI, so the Global Reporting Initiative. That was one of the initial ones at accounting. Then you mentioned TCFD. That's a Task Force on Climate-Related Disclosures. And some of our listeners might be seeing that already in accounting. They might be being asked some questions from the bank. If you're in the primary sector in New Zealand or anywhere, you are certainly seeing a steady, you know, steady stream of more paperwork being demanded from you. And you wonder, then, hey, my job was farming. Since when did I become a bureaucrat? And since when have I started, you know, I can remember 15 years ago when I started farming in New Zealand, one rainy afternoon, one, you know, rough afternoon when you didn't want to be out on the farm, once a month, 2 hours, 3 hours was enough to knock out the paperwork. Wow. This year, at this point, 15 years later, I can say that it was taking a couple of hours, maybe even 4 hours every week to make sure you were on top of things, the compliance, because you have companies pushing this. And what's coming next is something Don and I have often mentioned there, but very recently a report came out in New Zealand talking about what we need to do for reducing emissions. And one of the things there was we need to start monetizing nature. We need to start putting a value on every bit of biodiversity, and we need to start now incentivizing farmers and landowners, giving us payments for that. And that's, for me, that's the last straw, Lorraine. You know, that things which people were doing of their own initiative, we first had emissions and emission offsets. You're not going to have biodiversity offsets. As we speak, next month in Colombia, the United Nations has the COP16, the biodiversity COP, because they have the carbon COP, the climate COP, that's later in the year. But they have all of this. You can just see how it all just fits in. And we've just gone on, you know, it's coming to the pointy end here, especially in the rural sector. And I'm a bit biased there.
Yeah. You know, you're reminding me, I used to live in Manhattan and go ahead, Don.
No. I want to hear your story first because I will say this. You came up with it on how it serves life, or how you, that's your feeling about how you serve life. I think that's what every one of us listening to this sort of show wants. We think we're serving life fine. We know we've got boundaries. We know that we think we know what common sense is, and yet we have these people that want to be almost coercively, well, they're oppressive and coercive against your effort. And yet all I want to do is serve life, just like you. It's a bit of a contradiction between us on some things, or, you know, it seems a contradiction because you've come from a different direction. But I think that's all Jaspreet and I want to do as well, is serve life.
Yeah. It's a bit scary. So the story I was going to tell actually just sort of underscores where you're coming from, Don. I mentioned I used to live in Manhattan. I was there for 10 years, 2009 to 2019. So really kind of peak climate mobilization, you might say, the largest climate marches on record, you know, Greta Thunberg coming into the scene, lots of dialogue. And I just, by kind of random serendipity, which seems to be a theme for me, I happened to live just a couple blocks away from the UN. So Climate Week would happen every September, gearing up right now, and it would follow on the UN General Assembly. And where I lived, I actually lived east of First Avenue, which anybody who knows Manhattan might know is, there's a lane where all the kind of heads of state and dignitaries that are coming up from the UN, they're going to be shepherded along up First Avenue, which means there's a lot of security, a lot of barricades, all kinds of things, which meant for me to just kind of go get milk at the store. I couldn't cross the street. There's snipers on the roofs. Like, I was sort of in it by accident, right? Like, just surrounded by the crazy, crazy security and the intensity of New York City. And I was working as a sustainability consultant. And so I'd never heard of Climate Week until I moved to New York. And then I kind of got pulled into it, working at sustainability, working with folks. And it struck me as a very bizarre form of sort of cocktail party-itis. Like, it was really all about what events were you going to. And I'm friendly, I'm social, I like people, I've got good friends, I like to see folks. And there's folks I really do love, as I mentioned, from these teams and communities. So it would often be really a great chance to catch up. And people love going to New York for various reasons we could discuss under separate cover. And so it was like, it was a convergence. People wanted to go, right? Are you going to Climate Week? You're going to be at Climate Week? Or are you going to this lunch? Are you going to this dinner? And it was all about what you got invited to. And so I think, I feel very fortunate that I happened to just be there anyway to observe this. I didn't need to be invited. It literally was where I would go when I stepped out my front door. And watching the social vibe around it, I'm sure, again, there were people really trying to do the right thing, trying to make progress. But honestly, it reminded me a bit of high school. Like, who are you going to get? What are you going to get invited to? Who's going to be there? What are you going to wear? Will you have enough time to shop while you're there? Because that's where you want to go shopping. And I can say with honesty, and I would love to be proven wrong, and I dearly hope somebody will contradict and write into your show and be like, that Lorraine, she's full of crap. She overlooked this very important thing. But I can tell you, my 10 years in New York City, going to Climate Week, participating in lots of stuff, helping VIPs from client companies and whatever do the important things. I never once saw something that I actually thought, ah, now this is going to serve life.
Save the world. Yeah.
This is going to help people. This is going to make a real difference for, you know, even orangutans, you know, or like my migratory birds are the ones that I keep a real watch on. And I just think, oh my God, even as we're sitting in these god-awful air-conditioned towers in New York, migratory birds are about to lose their lives by the millions, the hundreds of millions, as they smash into these towers. The flyways here are just riddled with terror for migratory birds, bats, and other species. And we're sitting around like wondering what we're going to wear and comparing our shoes. It's horrific. So Dawn, I think the one thing I really want to invite is I get cautious, although I agree with you and I can't really argue, I get cautious about phrases like those people, because a phrase like those people sets us apart. We are those people. You know, we're talking on electronics that use that lithium, that use that cadmium, that use that copper. And although maybe I think I'm smarter than those shoe comparers in Manhattan, I'm also not, you know? And so I bring it back to what can I do now to serve? And what don't I know? Where are my blind spots? Because goodness knows, 10 years ago, I thought the job was to reverse global warming. I thought the job was better carbon accounting. And I thought early on, and then I saw the danger signs, I thought the nature-based accounting was going to be a good thing. And then I started to talk with people in the Global South. I started to talk with more Indigenous people, people with very different ways of knowing and being and counting, as we call it. And then the danger signals really started to perk up. So I can't spend too much time in the those people zone without realizing I'm those people and I can only do my job. And I'll keep doing it. I'll probably keep screwing it up and getting muddled and having to reorient every once in a while. But I try to sit with, not in a like paternalistic way, not in a, oh, those people, I should feel badly. No, like I really am those people and I should hold them with as much care as I hold myself and those migratory birds. I don't know if that feels like an excuse, but that's where I land, even though I do feel the pain.
And that's probably a very good place for us to land this interview. It's been fabulous talking to you, Lorraine. Our job is to try and tell all sides of the story and get people, get guests on to tell their view. I think that's what we're, as I said before, we're all trying to do is serve the people, serve life, sorry, and get the education out to people, whichever side they are on currently. If this moves one person to think differently, or at least think about life, then we've done our job. So thank you, Lorraine, for coming on to RCR Greenwashed. You've given up quite a bit of your time and a busy day, so we're appreciative of that. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you so much, both Jaspreet and Dawn. It's a pleasure. I look forward to listening to more of your shows. I've enjoyed them so far and happy to stay connected. All the best.
Fabulous. Thank you so much.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.